You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello and welcome to Sea Realm Radio on WOOL 91.5 FM in Bellows Falls. I'm KMO, and my guest this week is Professor Richard D. Wolfe. He is Professor of Economics Emeritus, University of Massachusetts Amherst, where he taught economics from 1973 to 2008. He's currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs at the New School University in New York City. And it's quite likely that he will be a familiar voice to you because his nationally syndicated weekly program, Economic Update, runs right here on Black Sheep Radio on Thursday mornings at 9 o'clock, right after Democracy Now! So here's my conversation with Professor Richard D. Wolfe. Professor Richard Wolfe, welcome to Sea Realm Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm very glad to have you here. As I've mentioned in the email that we exchanged, your program, Economic Update, runs on this very radio station. So it is good to have a nationally syndicated and recognized radio personality here on WOOL.
Well, I started with a local radio station back in 2011, WBAI in New York City, and it's been quite a ride since then. I frankly am continuously overwhelmed by the interest in what we are doing, the spread. We're now on about 90 stations across the United States, and indeed that radio presence has now been supplemented by television. So we are, if any of you are interested in that program you hear on the radio, it's also available in a televised form.
And when you say we, I assume that's not the royal we. Who else are you talking about?
Well, I can't do all this myself. I mean, I started as just an individual doing a radio hour on WBAI, as I said. But once you become syndicated, once you have to produce a fairly complicated radio show that is adjusted for a huge variety of stations, who want, one wants it for 57 minutes, one wants it for 59 minutes. Now on television, you have to secure studios, you have to secure interviewee guests who come on the program. So I'm now a little business. I have two full-time and four part-time people. And, of course, that means you have to raise money to pay their salaries. So it's now it's an operation. It's a set of problems. Of course, it's the kind of problems that folks like us used to dream of having. So I'm not complaining. I'm thrilled at the interest in what I do. You know, I've been a professor and a teacher all my life, so having someone come into the room to listen to me is what I've done all my life. And now to have that in the, literally in the millions, is, it's a very heady experience, but like all things, it brings problems along with the achievements. And we're kind of struggling to keep up since, to put it bluntly, the problems of the American economy, now compounded by the Trump administration, are the best recruiters for audience I could have imagined.
I'm sure. You mentioned that you, for a living, you stand in a room in front of people and talk, but yep. Those audiences simply cannot scale the way media can, you know, audiences for a program. What has that been like to have so many people tune in to your point of view in such a, not to say it's been a short period, but in terms of your whole career, a short period?
It has been a short period in my career, short period historically, literally from 2011 would be as good a place to count it. Before that, I had been, like most university professors, talking to audiences that were 10 people in a graduate seminar, up to maybe 200 or 300 in an undergraduate introductory economics lecture. I always like to teach both kinds of courses, so I had a mixture of that. But yes, and now it's somewhat overwhelming. I, in addition to doing the program once a week for an hour, I'm on a lot of media because people are interested in interviewing me. I think here in the United States, people like me who have spent a long time in their lives developing a critique of capitalism, of the economic system we live in, we find ourselves a relatively scarce group, a small group, because it was not good for your academic career, just as it wasn't that good for any other kind of career, but particularly in academia, being critical of capitalism was a very bad career move. In other words, it made all kinds of potential academic employers shy away from you. It made your colleagues where you were teaching nervous about associating with you. Was not a ticket upward. So a lot of people, therefore, got off that train. Even if they found a critical position to be intellectually satisfying, it entailed too many other problems. And so the number of us who stayed with it across the 70s, 80s, 90s, and into the new century was a shrinking number for much of that time. And so now, like what happens when fashion fads shift, now that the winds have changed, those of us that are left who have spent a lifetime developing critiques are a rare commodity, but suddenly there's a big demand. And to be honest, yes, I'm enjoying that no end. The ironies of it, the I told you so moments, they come quite often, and they are a bit of solace for what we had to go through earlier.
So I think I recall reading recently that you think that the end of capitalism in the West or in the United States is basically at hand. Is that right?
Well, I tell you, I've been all my life skeptical of the predictions business. Economics is a complicated field. It tries to understand how and why we produce the goods and services we do at the prices we charge, yielding the incomes we have. And those of us who've been doing it a long time understand that we only know the tip of that iceberg of explanation. So when it comes to predicting what things are going to happen, I don't believe in that. I think that the only place where that is appropriate is in a carnival where you can go talk to that lady and she looks in your palm or the creases in your forehead, tells you who your boyfriend or girlfriend's going to be in a few weeks, and you giggle and you laugh and you enjoy that, and I'm fine with that. But if you actually took it seriously and began to organize your life around what that lady said, then I would feel bad for you. And that's how I feel for people who take seriously the predictions economists make. Having said that, though, here's what I do believe. I have never in my lifetime, and I've been around a long time, seen the American economy, which I was born into and lived here all my life, facing this network of difficulties, armed with so few solutions that look even vaguely like they have a chance. And let me underscore that. I say so publicly that that's the way it looks to me. I think that capitalism, like all economic systems, was born, evolved, and changed over time. And like every other system that passed away, it's clear to me that capitalism will pass away too. I see no reason to assume that what happened to every other economic system, feudalism, slavery, you name it, is somehow not going to happen to capitalism. That strikes me as the odd prediction, not the normal one. So the real question isn't whether capitalism is going to disappear, because that's a little bit like asking, are you going to die? It's not an interesting question. We know the answer. But the interesting part is how, where, when. And for that, I would say that capitalism can't be predicted as to the how, where, and when. But I can tell you that a clue that we're not as far away from that process as we thought we were is contained in the following fact. Because I went to elite universities here in the United States, I have friends who are economists, who are right-wing economists, left-wing economists, and those in the middle. and we don't agree on how the United States got into the situation it's in now, and we don't agree on how it should get out. But we do agree on something, and it surprised all of us. And here's what we agree on, that the United States economy today is in greater difficulty, in worse shape, than any of us have ever seen or experienced in our lifetimes. And that agreement is the basis upon which I'm fairly confident that we are going to see some big changes and some big troubles in the near future.
So the right-wing economists that you know who agree with you that the economic situation in the United States is untenable, do you know any of them whose solution is anything other than more of what got us into this?
No. Basically, that's the problem. They may have more extreme versions. For example, there are right-wing economists, I won't mention names, who are absolutely convinced that the solution to all economic problems, including those we have today, are to get the government out of the economy. They have been singing that song all of their adult lives. They believe that. And so for them, what they want to see is a government that is reduced to the absolute minimum, and they don't even agree amongst themselves what that minimum exactly is, but it shouldn't have, for example, there shouldn't be taxes, there shouldn't be minimum wages, there shouldn't be regulations virtually of any kind. They're convinced that if you leave the capitalist system to the decision-making power of entrepreneurs, businessmen and women, everything will come out okay. I mean, I'm not being fair in the sense that there are nuances to their positions, but in the broad sweep, that's an extreme right-wing position. So their solution would be deregulate, shrink the economy, by all means cut taxes, for example, in the way that the Trump administration announced last week, do all of that and get the government out of the economy. It's the solution. It's literally the reverse of what dominant thinking in the United States was in the aftermath of the Great Depression of the 1930s. That Great Depression, worse even than the one we've been in since 2008, that Great Depression convinced the overwhelming majority of Americans that private enterprise capitalism was the problem, not the solution. And so the solution they found, led by the then President Franklin Roosevelt, was a mammoth intervention by the government in the economy so it would work better, at least better for the mass of people. And in short, after the Great Depression, private capitalism was the problem, government intervention was the solution. My right-wing economists today take exactly the opposite perspective. Government intervention for them is the economic problem, and minimizing that intervention becomes the solution.
Earlier, when you were talking, you mentioned him just briefly, and we can leave it at that, but you mentioned that the current president compounded the economic troubles that the nation faces. I think that's important to elaborate on because I, particularly from my left-wing friends on Facebook, I read a lot of narratives that basically paint the current president as the architect of all evils in the world and everything that besets us.
Yes, I would disagree with that. I don't think he's the origin of everything that besets us or of all evil. He's not attractive. I wouldn't claim that.
Understatement.
Yeah, but the problems go way beyond Mr. Trump. They predate him. They go beyond anything he has done since he's been the president. And they go beyond anything he's likely to do short of a nuclear war with North Korea or some other insanity. Let me try to explain. First, Mr. Trump is himself the product of modern American capitalism. The good and the bad, the extreme and the bland. Let me explain that in some detail. One of the remarkable things that happened after World War II was that the United States emerged from that war as the only intact economy of the developed part of the world. Western Europe had destroyed itself in World War II. The Soviet Union had suffered more casualties and more destruction even than the rest of Europe had, so it was decimated and in no position to be a powerful influence in the world economy, and the same goes for Japan. And the rest of the world was basically a colonial appendage of Western Europe, North America, and Japan. So the United States then enjoyed an absolutely unique position, the only economy that had suffered no bomb damage other than the Pearl Harbor event at the beginning, had in fact put everybody back to work in the war economy so that the Great Depression was finally ended by the war, and came out of the war the place everybody else had to go to rebuild their economies, which is what the United States then enjoyed, a kind of boom, recovering from its own depression while providing to the rest of the world the equipment, the means, the finances to rebuild from a devastating war. And it meant prosperity here in the United States, unexpected, a booming prosperity, not so much, not only in terms of the people that were here, but we became a mecca for people from other parts of the world to come here for jobs, to participate in that boom. Well, if you have a boom and you have people coming, one of the immediate beneficiaries is the real estate business, because there's a great demand for offices, a demand for factories, a demand for stores, not only for the native population, but for the immigrant population coming in. And to own real estate, which the Trump family did, was to be in the right position at the right time. So Mr. Trump's wealth is itself a product of the boom, this extraordinary boom that happened after World War II, and that lasted at least in its ebullient phase, in its rapid growth phase, roughly from 1945 to 1975. After that, the last 40 years or so, economic growth has slowed in the United States. The rest of the world caught up, Western Europe and Japan particularly, and a new player, the People's Republic of China, took off to become now a global economic superpower, number two only to the United States. Under these changed circumstances, the gap between rich and poor in the United States once again took on its long-term historical pattern of becoming worse and worse. Masses of people couldn't afford the American dream they had been led to believe was available to them, built into the country's DNA. They weren't going to be participating. They still can't believe it. They postponed facing up to it by borrowing money in the last 30 years. On a scale no working class has ever borrowed money before, and it all crashed in 2008. The other side of that crash was the growing concentration of enormous wealth in a smaller and smaller part of our population. And those wealthy people, for whom the post-war period was an uninterrupted explosion of wealth, they want to live in a very few places in this country. They want to have their ideal location, and they find it in places like San Francisco, New York City, Chicago. You can fill in the blank. Therefore, if you own real estate in one of the places that rich people like to go, then you will enjoy a boom not only after World War II to 1975, but from 1975 right to this minute. Once again, Mr. Trump was sitting on the right real estate at the right time, most of which he had access to, A, because of his father, and number two, because of developments in the economy that he didn't create, that he isn't responsible for, but that he cleaned up from. So it's clear that Mr. Trump is literally a product of the way capitalism has developed, warts and all. And he is in no position, and he has never had a thought to question, to criticize. He's riding the gravy train of this system. He's making money off the growing inequality. He has never done anything to undermine that inequality, partly because it would have been self-destructive of him to do that. And if you know anything about him, you can see that self-criticisms or self-abnegation or self-anything else other than celebration is really not part of this man's character. He's a real estate hustler during a real estate boom. And so to expect him to have or to gather around him people with an awareness, a sophistication, a sensitivity to our economic problems and a developed notion of how to deal with them, it's unfair to him. That's not who he is, not who he's ever been. There's not the slightest shred of evidence that the man has any interest in, any experience in identifying, studying, or trying to solve the economic problems. From his perspective, there aren't any. And therein lies the enormous danger he represents for the United States, as does the fact that he is in a position to choose other people who strike him as having understanding of this economy. The people gathered around him, and not just Mr. Scaramucci and the joke that that represented, but Mr. Mnuchin, Gary Cohn, the Blues Brothers from Goldman Sachs, all of this, these are people who have, like him, ridden this economy on the gravy train, who think everything is wonderful because it's made them a lot of money, and it has, and therefore these are not the people you need or want if the economy is in trouble. These are people who are happier than pigs in a certain place and are not about to solve our problems. And I think you can see already in the first months of the Trump administration, you can see the evidence of that everywhere.
When I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio on WOOL, Black Sheep Radio, 91.5, Bellows Falls, Vermont. I'm KMO, your host, and I'm speaking with Professor Richard D. Wolff. Unfortunately, the recorded conversation with Professor Wolff is longer than the one-hour format of this radio show will allow, so I had to cut a few minutes, and those few minutes are gone now. The bit that I cut was a largely unstructured conversation, so you're not missing a whole lot. But for those who absolutely want to hear the whole thing, the bit that I cut out can be found in Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 267, which I will post later today, and you can find that on my website. It is c-realm.com. All right, and now back to the conversation with Professor Wolff. Issue, you don't have to worry about it too much. I didn't study economics. I studied philosophy, and I did go to grad school, and I did, at first I was a teaching assistant, so I taught, you know, small groups that from a big lecture course, and then later I was given my own classes. And I distinctly remember one day walking to campus, and I lived half mile, three quarters of a mile from campus in Missouri, and a very, very cold day, you know, bitter wind, and I'm just hunched over, and I'm walking to campus, and I've just about reached the building where I teach, and I see one of my students pull up in what must have been a $30,000 sports car and, you know, jump out. He's wearing shorts because, you know, he just has to walk from the frat house or, you know, his apartment or wherever to the car, and then he can, you know, drive in the heated car. And it was just a very difficult instant, you know, to realize that this young person who is sitting in my class because he thought maybe it would be an easy way to, you know, get through one academic requirement, really has nothing to worry about and never will. You know, maybe that's changed. I mean, it is possible, and I think increasingly easy to fall out of the comfortable side of the distribution into the uncomfortable side. A lot of people have done it. Let me pause there and talk about the growing divide, because, you know, we think about people getting poorer and the rich getting richer, but people who had been fairly comfortable, you know, as the rich end contracts and the richest get even richer, there are people falling out of what they thought were safe, predictable life circumstances into what's now called the precariat.
Absolutely. And they number in the millions. And this is happening in the United States very dramatically. It's happening in a number of other countries, particularly in Europe. So yes, this is a global phenomena, and it is variously termed the demise of the middle class or the vanishing middle class. I never understood what middle literally means, unless it's just arithmetic in the sense that you make more money than people below you and less money than people above you. And by that standard, of course, we're all or almost all in the middle, so that things loses meaning. The way I would put it is we had developed in the United States now a peculiar mental situation across the whole history of the United States through much of the 19th century and the 20th century, at least since the Civil War and up until the 1970s. If you look at that long span, a century and a half, it really was true in the United States that every generation in general lived at a higher standard of living than the previous generation. It became reasonable for parents to say to their children, verbally, but also in all the subtle ways that parents and children communicate, that you're in for a better job than mommy or daddy have. You're going to live in a nicer house. You're going to be able to go to school and get a good education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because the working class in America, having taken the land from the people who had it before them, not so nice, ethnic cleansing of the worst sort, were nonetheless able in that situation with the climate and the fertility of the soil in this country to experience economic growth, capitalism growing for 150 years. And not only did capitalism become bigger and richer, but it shared, partly because it had to, at least a portion of the growing wealth with the people who produced it, the workers. And so the workers, too, had a rising standard of living. They didn't rise as fast as the people at the top. The gap was always widening. But they didn't question that so long as their little piece of the pie was also growing. It gave an expectation. It made this thing we call American exceptionalism, the notion that somehow we here in the United States lived in a kind of charmed economic universe, which only got better and better and better. Even in the Great Depression of the 1930s, when this capitalism collapsed and really showed the capacity to hurt people on an unbelievable scale, even then, because the prices of goods and services fell even faster than the incomes of our working class, they didn't suffer anywhere near the kind of disruption they might have, because we collapsed the inequality in those years. We made America much more equal than it had been before or than it has been since. It was a very exceptional period, the New Deal. Anyway, with all of this story, once the war is over and the Depression becomes a memory, the capitalism of growing inequality resumes, but with this difference. The United States is now part of a world economy, and it can make use of the resources around the world. It doesn't have to rely only on its own working class. When you have to rely on your own working class, you kind of have to meet them halfway, or else you're going to have a revolution in your society. We came close enough in this country in many phases with pitched battles between working armed working class people and the armed Pinkertons and Wackenhuts organized by the other side. We know that story real well. After World War II, American business decided it had the whole world's workers at its disposal. It began moving more and more jobs out of the United States so that today we are quite accustomed to put on clothes that we know were not made in the United States, sit down at our kitchen table with furniture that was not made in the United States, eating food that was not made in the United States, getting into a car that either wasn't made in the United States or was made by a foreign company here in the United States. We understand that the world is global. What we don't understand is what it meant. What it meant was that billions, with a B, of workers outside the United States who had, over the 150 years where our standard of living was going up, not enjoyed anything like it, who had fallen further and further behind to create what we now understand to be third world wage and income levels. They were desperate for work, eager for General Motors and General Electric and General, you name it, to move from Ohio and Michigan to China and India and Brazil, to take advantage of the low wages those workers were willing to live with. And so American workers began to discover they were not able to get a deal out of American employers anymore. If they pushed for rising wages the way they had in the past, they'd lose the job altogether. They were shocked. They were defeated. They were dispirited. And we're now living in 30 years of this catastrophe. And the result for American workers is the deep depression, psychological as well as economic, that comes when you face or have to face that you live in an economic system driven by profit, and that while that profit-driven system worked for you and your forebears in America for 150 years up until the 1970s, roughly, it hasn't. That is, the same profit-driven capitalism has moved. Its center of gravity is in China and India and Brazil. It's not here in the United States. The top 10% here cash in because of the low wages they pay in the rest of the world. But for the vast majority of Americans, this is an unmitigated disaster. It's been that way since the 1970s. It's been no longer possible to live the American dream. If you promise a higher standard of living to your children, you're going to make them as well as yourself very disappointed, which is what has been happening. It was postponed for a while from roughly the middle 70s to 2008 by this borrowing binge in which Americans, to hold on to the dream when the wages no longer went up and couldn't afford it, they borrowed to do it. But you don't need an advanced degree to know that if you keep borrowing more and more, which the American working class did, on a foundation of wages that didn't go up, it's only a matter of time before you reach the limit. You can't service the debt you've accumulated on the wages you're getting and have any prospect of getting. And that's where we've been in the last few years. And that creates, and I don't mind saying it, depressed people, angry people, bitter people, and those individuals who literally snap, like Mr. Paddock in Nevada, because there are too many pressures, disconnections, lost opportunities, frayed families, dispersed communities. These things take a toll on people. And for those who have personal difficulties of a higher order, it can literally be too much. And the evidence is everywhere. We have a higher rate of suicide in the United States than we have had in decades, if ever. We are getting sick on a scale that is altogether new. We are having one psychological difficulty after another. Americans, for example, barely 4.5% of the world's population consume more than half of the antidepressant drugs produced on this planet. Now, you could try to explain that by saying that Americans are, you know, physically or chemically drug dependent, but I don't believe that at all. I think Americans are under an extraordinary historical pressure of a capitalist system that they hold on to for dear life because it did serve them well for a long time. But the thought that this system has moved on, that this system, at least in this part of the world, is on the downward side of its mountain trip, no longer going up, now going down, that is so frightening. That presents so many difficulties to get your head around it that we have a kind of phenomena of mass denial. And one product of that is putting a man like Donald Trump in the position that he's in. That's a sign that a society is desperate.
You mentioned the most recent mass shooting. I hadn't even memorized the shooter's name. I'm just not interested in the details. But I am enormously frustrated that whenever something like this happens, which, you know, given our circumstances is not surprising and it will happen again, the conversation on social media exclusively gravitates to that, with people saying the exact same things they said the last time there was such a shooting. And it completely overshadows the fact that, and I've heard you mention this recently, over 60,000 people in the United States a year are dying from overdoses or, yep, you know, other causes related to dependency on opiates. And yet, you know, the tiny, tiny minority of people who, instead of, you know, medicating themselves and basically opting for slow suicide via addiction, explode and kill a bunch of people in a spectacular fashion. Well, you know, the news media picks that up and they repeat it endlessly. And, you know, that sort of dynamic, exciting, attention-grabbing spectacle overshadows this enormous human tragedy just repeatedly, reliably, regularly. And it's just, it's disheartening in a way that I'm failing to describe right now.
No, I think you're describing it very well. One of the reasons I repeat that statistic is my hope that people will try to get their heads around the notion that we are literally killing ourselves. Taking an overdose of drugs can be an accident and an inadvertent phenomena, of course, but it's also a kind of mass suicide. You know, a few months ago, there were young workers in China who apparently jumped out of windows of factories because the pace of work demanded of them, the pressures they were put under, made them want to give up their lives. And it got enormous attention here in the United States, in Western Europe, because, of course, it was interpreted with some justice to be a sign of economic turmoil and injustice in China. What struck me in that coverage was there wasn't the effort to pinpoint something individual about the individual who had jumped out the window. Of course, there are always individual facts and circumstances that explain why John or Mary takes such an extreme step. But if lots of Johns and lots of Marys are doing it, it becomes a social issue, and it becomes necessary to look at it. The terrible shooting in Las Vegas a few days ago is unfortunately typical for the United States. We have more mass murders of this sort than any other country. Nobody is even close to us. There was a statistic carried in a number of newspapers that showed that of the 10 countries that have the most of it, the most of these experiences, here's how many people die per million in all of them except the United States, somewhere between 3 and 4. 3 and 4 people die from a mass shooting of some sort or a mass murder per million. In the United States, that number is in excess of 30, not 3 or 4, right? We're off the chart. We have, again, 4.5% of the world's population. We own 43% of the personally owned weaponry, guns, long and short, in the world. I mean, we are off the chart a nation that is deeply troubled by things that make it kill itself, whether it's by opioids or whether it's by gun violence and so on. And we don't want to ask the question that we immediately did in the case of China. What is it about our society that is producing this kind of mass behavior? And particularly, what is it about our economy? We were quick to identify the economic pressures in China that produced their experience, which is much smaller, let me remind everyone, much smaller per population than ours is. But we were quick to identify economic roots of the phenomena there. We are equally and in the opposite way unwilling to ask the question, let alone answer it. But I've tried in a little bit of history I gave you a few minutes ago to begin to provide an explanation of how and why the deep economic disappointment since the 1970s, the requirement, particularly for white males, that the kinds of jobs they had for so long paid enough not only for themselves, but to take care of a wife and children at home, the so-called family wage, given the respect of having the better jobs, the jobs with benefits, with security, and all the things that go, all of that has been taken away from them, making them bitter, making them do that very American thing, which is not to ask the question about how the system is doing something, but to turn inward, to blame yourself, to think that somehow that you don't have the job you thought you were in line to get is your fault, your mistake, your self-destructive this or that. And then, of course, you take to drugs or to drinking to the solace of the self, because you've ended up in this apoplectic self-blame syndrome from which it is very hard to escape. My wife's a psychotherapist. I can see in her face as she treats her clients, her patients, the sadness that grips her too as she watches people's lives unravel. And I explain to her so she understands that this is not primarily anything to do with the individual circumstances of the people who come to see her. It has to do with this social phenomena. That's why it is so surprising when she explains to her clients that the particularities they bring to her attention aren't particular to them at all, that there are millions of people who sit and walk amongst us, each of whom believes that their particular job history, their particular difficulty in making relationships with other people is somehow peculiar to them. The tragedy there is of a society falling apart that doesn't need to, which if it understood its own history better, its own dilemmas better, would be in much healthier shape to cope much more successfully with the problems it has.
I remember I wasn't living there yet, but I was visiting New York City in the fall of 2011 when Occupy Wall Street was taking place. And I went to a couple of Occupy Wall Street events. And then I left there and I went with my then new girlfriend to her mother's place. And she lives up in on the Upper East Side. And my girlfriend was born in the Soviet Union, as was her mother, and all of their friends who were assembled at this dinner party. And this was a bunch of baby boomers, basically, who had been born in the Soviet Union, who all had technical educations that were provided to them, you know, for free in the Soviet Union, who then came to the United States in the late 70s and got jobs in technical fields and made a lot of money and did rather well. And they had no sympathy whatsoever for the people who were assembled in Zuccotti Park. And the explanation that I got again and again for the economic troubles that beset this generation is that it's just a, you know, repeated iteration of individual personal failure and laziness. And that is the reason that so many people are struggling economically. And if they just, you know, buckled down and worked the way these Soviet-born immigrants to the United States did, that they would have the same results. And they were just not open to the idea that it was anything other than personal virtue that determined the course of one's life if you live in the United States, which for them is, you know, it really is the land of milk and honey.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always been the defense of the rich, of the well-paid, that have to look around them and see so many other people unable to share in whatever wealth or good income that they have. Everybody has to face that unless you literally enable yourself not to see around you. And once you see all the other people not doing real well, you then have to, because that's the way the human animal is structured, you have to come up with a story about this. You have to have some way to explain to yourself and everybody else why you have and the others don't. And one way to do that is to say, look, this is a system which has a structure that leads it to reward, I'll pick a number, 10% of its population with a decent life, a good job, a nest egg of some savings to rely on for rainy days, etc. And for the other 90%, it doesn't have that, and they're not going to get that. You could look at it that way, and then you could ask the question, why am I in the 10%, whereas my neighbor is in the other 90%? But that would bring you into the area of social criticism. Because if you're a decent human being, which most folks are, you will understand that, gee, there might be something wrong with the system that gives 10% of the people such a good outcome and 90% poor. And it wouldn't be all that surprising if the 90% that you encounter every day were grumbling, were angry. You'd have to kind of sympathize with them, wouldn't you? Well, this is a dangerous road to begin to travel on, because it takes you into the realm of social criticism, of social opposition. And this is not good to keep your place in the 10%, because the fellow 10%ers like you don't like to hear this sort of stuff. So you invent a different story. The story goes, I'm in the 10% because I'm not lazy. I'm in the 10% because I deserve to be. And from there, it's a very small step to saying that the other 90% are out of the money because they deserve to be out of the money. They don't work hard. They're not smart. They didn't study in school, or whatever other story you tell yourself. In other words, it's a self-defense, this kind of nonsense about working hard and lazy. The poorest people on earth, and I can introduce you to many of them, work very hard. They work really hard. To say that the 90% don't work hard is not only insulting to them, it speaks of such monumental ignorance on your part that it's hard not to become angry at people who make their good fortune even worse by disparaging the others. And the proof of the pudding is, in societies like the Soviet Union, and even like the United States, you can point to times in history when it wasn't 10% and 90%, when it was much more like 50-50 or 40-60. And then you couldn't make these arguments about the few who are hard workers or anything else like that. Or you can read the countless novels written about the people in the bottom half of the population, showing how smart they are, how hard they work, how monumental is their achievement in the face of adversity, and so on. it takes a mentality, and I don't want to disparage your sweetheart's family here, but it takes a mentality that is almost pathologically self-defensive to come up with that kind of an argument. You know, here's a statistic to think about. 2016 was a remarkable year in the statistical history of the American economy. Because last year, and of course it continues this year, we reached the following milestone. The top 10% of the American people own more than half the total wealth in this society. The other 90% own less than half. Now that is a fundamental inequality. Because of the virtual absence of estate taxes in the United States, 32 states have no estate tax, and the federal estate tax does not apply to the first $10 or $11 million that you leave, which means it doesn't apply to 99% of American people. We have, in effect, no estate tax, which means that the 10% at the top can and do leave their wealth to their children. Those children begin life very wealthy, able to buy the tutoring, the schooling, the supports, the experiences that will give them way better chance in life to get an education, to get skills, to get help, to get a good job, and they're wealthy to begin with, compared to the mass of people who have nothing, who leave nothing to their children. We don't start in this country on a level playing field. We never did. The playing field is so tilted that 90% of the people roll right off it. For those 10% to then tell themselves a story that they did it, it's disgusting. And the story of the Soviet Union is one step more disgusting, because that was a society that taxed everybody in order to provide a free education to everyone. And they benefited from that. And after they got the education paid for by the Soviet people, they came over here and delivered their qualifications to a society that hadn't paid a nickel to give them those qualifications. They ought to be ashamed of having done it. They ought to be quiet about what the end results were. But instead, to tell a story as if their benefits and this country's allowing them to participate in the top 10% is somehow the fruit of their individual effort, and then to insult the people who were not given these opportunities. As everyone knows who knows anything about Soviet education, it was way superior to what most Americans get in their public schools. There is no basis for what they have to say other than an unpleasant, unlovely, self-defensive unwillingness to ask the very questions that make us part of a community rather than a collection of individuals.
We have been on the line for over an hour, and so it's time to wrap up. I will give you the opportunity, though, to, if you choose to, end on a positive note or a hopeful note, and also to mention the websites that you are always mentioning on your own show.
I'd love to, and thank you for the opportunity. I am, in fact, an optimist. I always have been, and I feel very positive. My own experience, my personal experience in the last 6 years, 2011, 2017, is that an enormous number of Americans, numbering in the many millions, is in fact understanding how this economy works, is in fact courageous and asking the critical questions, is in fact coming up with the analytical answers that make me very hopeful for the future. I think everything from Occupy Wall Street back in 2011 to the extraordinary outpouring of support for Bernie Sanders in the last general election, to the growing audience, radio and TV, for programs, not just mine, but programs like mine that are proliferating across the social media space in the world. These are signs of a growing critical awareness that is what we need to answer the questions about a faltering capitalism and what comes next and where to go. My own inclination that changing the organization of enterprises from the top-down hierarchical capitalist way we've been doing it to a democratic worker cooperative-based economy, I think that's the ticket out. I think that's the way to get an economy that works for all the people by putting all the people in charge of the enterprises rather than having the tiny minority that dominates those enterprises the way they do it now. And in any case, you can see the evidence I have, you can see the analytical resources I rely on by taking advantage of the websites that we maintain for that purpose. They're available 24/7, no charge whatsoever. The first one is Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info, and I invite you to make use of all the resources there. And the other one is R.D. Wolf, that's me, R.D. Wolf with two Fs.com. The two are linked together, so you can go from one to the other. And finally, I do invite you to take a look at the TV version of my regular show, as well as, or in addition to, the radio availability on your station there, as well as across the country. All of that you can find through the websites. And then you can become, in a sense, part of the very fast-growing community of people who are not going to be passive, who are not going to be turning inward, who are not going to distinguish themselves from everybody else by imagining they have the skills that got them to where they are, but are rather feeling part of a larger community whose economic system does not serve enough of them well enough and therefore needs to be changed. I want to remind everyone that here in America, we're kind of proud that back in 1776, we made the decision that the colonial British system was a system that wasn't working for the people who had come and landed and built the colonies here. And we broke away from a system that wasn't working for us. And we said we didn't want this or that reform, and we didn't want King George to behave a little differently than he had before. We were beyond all that. We had tried that. We were quitting. We were going to leave that system, and we were going to set up a different, better system. No kings, no colonies, none of it. That was a dramatic change. And that's how we became a nation. The same questions we asked then about an inadequate political colonial system, we now have to ask about the capitalism that we set up back then and that has now run its course, is not serving except a tiny number of people, however deluded they may be. And for the rest of us, it's time to put on that hat of social criticism and social change. It worked for us in 1776. We need it now again.
Amen.
Okay.
Professor Richard D. Wolf with two Fs, thank you very much for the work that you do, and thank you for appearing on C-Realm Radio.
My pleasure. Glad to talk with you.
That is all for this episode of C-Realm Radio. If you'd like to hear it again, you can find it on my website. It's crealm.com. That's the letter C and then a dash and then realm.com. I'm sorry I didn't have time for the public service announcements in this episode of the program. Blade Runner 2049 is playing at the Bellows Falls Opera House Theater. It is an amazing film. Go see it. Don't miss it on the big screen. All right, that is all. I'll talk to you again next week. Stay well.